with the third case of the morning, which is United States versus Chiojanco. Mr. Meyer.
May it please the court, John Meyer on behalf of the defendant Eduardo Chiojanco. Your Honor, this case presents the issue of how far down you can go in the corporate hierarchy and still apply the abuse of trust position to an employee in an embezzlement case. The district court's ruling here stands essentially for the proposition that there is no limit, that it's almost boundless. You can go to the lowest level and apply the abuse of trust position in a large corporation.
Was it possible to give a certain amount of trust and responsibility to people at low levels?
It certainly is, Judge, but that was not the case here. And I would suggest that if a review of the evidence indicates that the Hilton Hotel never made a conscious decision to place any amount of trust in Mr. Chiojanco. What they did is they assigned him routine, rudimentary tasks that had to do with nothing but entering data into a computer.
But Mr. Meyer, the government has suggested, and this I think is something you need to address, that our case law says that you don't look at mere job titles, you look at the substance of what the person is doing. This is a factual determination. Here we have a clear error standard, so no matter what they labeled this guy, you know, an accounts receivable clerk or, you know, the janitor or whatever else, if he in fact had that kind of trust, isn't the adjustment correct?
Well, going back one step, Your Honor, I would disagree that the standard of review here is clear error. The defendant is not contesting any factual determination by the district court. What we are contesting is the district court's interpretation and application of the guidelines to uncontested facts. Therefore, I would submit to the court that this is a de novo review of the district court's conclusion and interpretation that Mr. Chiojanco's duties and his job were a position of trust.
Well, even if it's a de novo review, though, he had the authority to decide whether the credit was going to be granted or not, didn't he? He had the wherewithal to conceal that. And I would think if you give somebody that position, you're entrusting the employee to be faithful to the company.
Oh, certainly. I mean, everybody, and I would concede that everybody that is given jobs that have to do with dealing with cash or credit cards, there is a certain amount of trust placed in that person. But likewise, there's a certain amount of trust placed in bank tellers, and they are excluded from this provision. Banks trust or place a certain amount of trust in tellers that they're not going to steal cash. But the way they do it is they audit the tellers. They check their work. And that's the same procedure that the Hilton Hotels had in this case. When Mr. Chiojanco made a decision that there was going to be a credit to somebody's customer account, his first job was to verify through the hotel records that person was entitled to a credit. Then it was sent to the comptroller.
When he did that verification, what kinds of things was he looking for? Was there any discretion involved at all in his efforts?
No, because say if somebody calls the Hilton Hotel and says, I was overcharged, I was billed for 3 nights, and I only stayed 2 nights. Well, Mr. Chiojanco had the responsibility to go to the hotel records and verify that guest only stayed 2 nights and therefore was entitled to a credit for 1 night stay. Then he would enter the credit for whatever that amount was on the data processing the spreadsheet on the computer, and that would go directly to the comptroller.
Now, so if somebody wrote in and said, I stayed at the Palmer House, but the rooms were really dirty, and I don't think I should have to pay the full amount for that. Would that be something he could credit someone for?
I don't believe so. I think that a decision like that, that it would involve a call as to whether somebody, because of goodwill or for some other reason, was entitled to a credit, that would not be Mr. Teal-Janko's job. That would be like the manager of the hotel. Somebody in a management position could determine, well, this guy's been a good customer for a number of years. We'll give him the credit. But Mr. Teal-Janko, he sat at a computer. That's all he did. Data would come in, he would transform it onto a computer screen, and it would go to the comptroller. So I would suggest to the court that essentially Mr. Teal-Janko had no discretion. In guideline parlance,
what role does the amount of money have to play here? You can say absolutely nothing, but it seems to me when you pocket over $250,000, as this guy did here, that he's been entrusted with significant responsibility and trust.
But I
don't know, the money should define whether it's a position of trust or not, but it just strikes me as a consideration that we should be making.
I would submit that it should not be a consideration because in this case and in the cases I've seen, it has not been a consideration. The district court didn't consider it. And the reason is that if somebody is able to steal a large amount of money because of lax supervision, then should that person be held accountable as occupying a position of trust?
Well, doesn't the amount of money factor in any way elsewhere in the guidelines?
Oh, absolutely.
So yeah. It's not that the amount of money is irrelevant, it's just you need to adjust for it here as well as other places.
I think that's correct. And in fact, I cited one case from another circuit, Brogan from the Sixth Circuit, where the individual stole $8 million and the abuse of trust enhancement was not applied.
I want to focus on just two things quickly. One is with regard to discretion. If someone calls in and says that, you know, I didn't use that, what do they call the little refrigerator and all that stuff where they
right.
Pocket pretty well if you open it up. And he said, I never touched it, and yet I got charged for 3 days or something.
Right.
Well, it also, they look at, if your client were to look at his thing and say, well, he stayed in a high rent room, he charged a lot of money at the bar and the restaurant, and he apparently comes every year, so we can waive that. You're saying he could not make that decision?
I mean, there's no evidence in the record that states that he had that kind of discretion.
And then the other, I guess the, if I were to call it a focus, if he is in a position that supposedly he's got a supervisor, this controller is supposed to check his work. Well, let's say after about 6 months he finds out he just sends this in legitimately and he says, hey, he's just rubber stamping me. So suddenly he realizes he's in, maybe unwarranted, but in a position of trust because the guy trusts him and does rubber stamps his stuff. You can call that negligence, and maybe it is, but could he assume that and then take on that cloak?
I think a person in Mr. Teal-Janko's position would assume that he's not being trusted, but that the comptroller is just lazy and not doing his job. He's just not checking.
I know, but
records.
He knows that now.
Right.
That's why he's doing it. And yep, so he suddenly has been bestowed, negligently perhaps, into a position of trust. Is that not a legitimate observation?
It is, from the respect that he is now in a position where he can steal money. I would submit to the court it's not because of any trust placed in him, but it's because of lax supervision. And I don't think an employee should be held responsible for that. It's the employer who places or who fails to monitor their employees who is ultimately responsible for that kind of theft. Although I'm not saying Mr. Teal-Janko can't be punished, it's the employer that holds that primary responsibility.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. King?
Good morning. We're asking you to affirm the factual findings of the district court, and the factual findings of the district court were that this defendant abused his position of trust.
But the primary question is whether he had one, because I take it he concedes that the position he had, whatever it may have been, was one that enabled him to, or facilitated, to use the word of the guideline, the commission and concealment of the but it facilitated both the commission and the concealment of the offense here. So the question is about the position, and I'd like you to address the definition of this term that appears in Application Note 1 of the guideline. In what sense did he have either professional or managerial discretion? That's the word that the guideline uses to define the term, and I don't see where he had discretion. I certainly see where he had the ability to, you know, create phony accounts that looked like somebody had stayed at the Palmer House and they hadn't, and, you know, do the things he did, but they didn't give him any discretion, did they?
Yes, Your Honor, they did, and the record supports and the factual findings support it. He had discretion because he was the person to speak directly to the customers. He was the person who determined what, if any, credit would be given to the particular customer,
but the question,
and in what amount.
Right, but the reason is why I was trying to ask those other questions, because if it's something simple like, did you use the minibar, and they go back and they check the housekeeping records where the housekeeping people check off, you know, did you take a little bottle of scotch out of the thing, and it shows that nothing was taken out and he was charged for it anyway, then certainly you have an objective track and he could turn in something saying, in fact, this person's entitled to a credit or how many nights or whatever. There are a lot of things that are just simple mistakes that get put into the system. There are other things of a more, if you will, discretionary nature. The room was dirty, or I was treated rudely by the front desk or what have you. Where adjustments are made, I don't know if you've ever stayed in a hotel and had to make a complaint, but sometimes they'll change things for you. Does he have that kind of discretion? I don't see why correcting somebody for two nights versus three nights is discretion.
First of all, counsel was wrong when he said that the defendant did not, the record established that the defendant did not have the discretion to correct it for a dirty room or he didn't like the service. The record was silent as to how he exercised his particular discretion. That particular fact was not elicited in the course of the hearing.
Isn't that the government's burden? You're the one who wanted this upward adjustment.
The defendant's position was that he had, it was his job, in addition to all the other duties he had of processing bills and collecting bills, his particular job entailed dealing with the customers, adjusting customer bills,
right.
And that he's the person who determined whether the bill could be adjusted.
But
that's
all I'm
as far
saying
as it went.
Right, okay. And so he gets the input. You know, he picks up the phone, talks to the customer. He checks the computer. He creates his report at the end of the day. I'm concerned in terms of proper application of the guideline in, let's say, the relevant information that needs to be developed in order to know if this is an abuse of, it's a position of public or private trust. And do you agree with me that it's the government's burden to show that, that by a preponderance, you know, that that kind of position exists?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree it's the government's burden, and I believe the government met the burden, and the district court was correct in making the factual finding that it did. And I think when you're looking at the application note, there's two questions. It's not just the discretion, it's also the nature of the responsibility entrusted to the victim.
So that what people who deal with money do not qualify for this upward adjustment?
An ordinary bank teller, a person who is subjected to close supervision. Unlike this defendant, an ordinary bank teller whose cash drawer is audited every day, a person who handles your bag at the hotel, who has no direct access to valuable items, who has no authority to give you a free room for the day.
But, you know, the perverse thing about that is you're suggesting that victims who are diligent and who supervise their tellers or who supervise their accounts receivable clerks closely will wind up with people who are punished at a lesser degree and victims who are sloppy, like the Palmer House, who don't bother to follow through with the various audit procedures that they have in place, get the benefit of greater punishment for dishonest employees.
Oh, that's not at all what I'm suggesting.
That's exactly the result, though.
What I'm suggesting to the court is if you have a long-term employee for 10 years in the accounting department who, over the course of time, you've come to trust and rely on and have no reason to trust, and you trust him with great items of value, where every day he's processing hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of credits and debits, and you have no reason to distrust him, your lack of supervision is an indication of your trust in him.
But is there any evidence in the record that the Palmer House monitored more closely the other 10 people in this department?
There is no evidence in the record as to what the nature of the other 10 people who sat in the accounting department did, other than the defendant and his supervisor, those two people. So the remaining 9, there was no specific discussion as to what they did or they didn't do.
So we don't know if they were actually reposing particular trust in him or whether they just were hoping everything was going well. I mean, if they did the same thing to everybody with respect to whatever each person's account receivable job was, then that leads to an inference that they just didn't supervise much. If they were particularly trusting of him, then maybe it does lead to where you're going.
Well, this is the particular defendant that had responsibility for processing the credit cards transactions and dealing with the particular customers and identifying which particular credit cards and debits and banking agencies would be credited out of the Hilton's bank account. That's the difference, that's this particular defendant, and that's why these particular facts support the factual finding by the court.
You said, I want to just verify two things. One is, in line with what you just said, that he determined whether the adjustment was valid. You said that earlier.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that is his decision, you know, his determination. Obviously, somebody could review it, but did he say yes or no initially?
His determination was who got credited and in what amount.
He made that decision.
He made that decision.
And then someone may have reviewed it, but it wasn't something he said, here's the situation, should he not get the credit?
He went to no one else to determine the amount or who got the credit, Your Honor. And in terms of the question of review, after this defendant filled out the rebate slips and entered the amounts that would be credited on a Lotus Excel spreadsheet, the spreadsheet was passed on to a supervisor who merely initialed it and sent it on to the night auditor for inputting. So there was no meaningful review by the supervisor.
There were two steps after him, though. He didn't actually order the bank transfer. Somebody else did.
He made the computer entries on the spreadsheet, which were then processed by the night auditor so that the electronic credits were actually inputted by the night auditor.
But he made the change.
But he made the necessary document changes and the specific entries so that the night auditor knew how much Visa would get as opposed to MasterCard or how much American Express would be getting. And by commingling the fraudulent transfers within the legitimate transfers,
and all of that,
no one else could tell.
All that is in evidence. The government proved that.
That's correct, John.
Now, the other question I have is the amount involved. You said something about hundreds of thousands of dollars a day, which I find baffling. How much of this $250,000 over 5 years represent vis-a-vis the total amount of credits given, if you know?
There is no information specifically in the record.
So we don't know what the daily
I don't know what the daily take of the Palmer House is.
Because here we're talking about $1,000 a week. I don't know whether that's a drop in the bucket or half of the credit.
There's no specific item in the record as to that. But I think the touchstone of this is the actual responsibility entrusted by the client. And in this particular case, he abused or exploited the fact that his supervisor merely initialed the computer spreadsheet, relied upon the fact that that he made a diligent and acted in the best interest of the client, that he made a diligent search, that he, when he decided who'd be refunded, what amounts would be paid, that he was acting in the best interest of the Hilton. And for this reason, the factual determination of the court wasn't clearly erroneous, and we'd ask that you affirm the conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Meyer?
I think my time is up.
Is that right? You got a little you said enough?
Well,
hurry up, your time's running. It might take you that long to get up here.
The only point, I want to go back to the bank teller analogy, and that is, if a bank teller was allowed, because of lack of supervision, to steal millions of dollars, would that bank teller then be in a position of trust? I suggest to the court that he would not.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Case will be taken under advisement.